And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. We are committed to bringing the most inspirational, informative, and significant people on the planet directly to your earbuds. And today is no exception, as you will see in just a few moments, or maybe I should say, as you will hear in just a few moments. This podcast today is transcendently important to everyone listening in, and that is because the whole world has been impacted by our subject on Hank Unplugged. Our subject is COVID-19, and the news cycle seems to be all COVID all the time. Here's what I mean. I got up this morning. I was in my office by 5:30. I always read three newspapers. And I was thinking before I did this podcast, I wanted to give you a little sense of what we are bombarded with. So I read the Charlotte Observer because I want to know about our local news and sports teams and so forth. Then USA Today, and then the Wall Street Journal. Here's the headline in the Charlotte Observer, our local newspaper. Schools to go remote, citing virus spread. And then you have on the front page an article about the police chief, a judge, all testing positive for COVID-19, that after taking a flight on an airplane. The daily increase in state COVID-19 cases roars another headline, highest since pandemic start. Another. Pandemic death toll has doubled in North Carolina prison since September. And then in the sports section, Coach K, by the way, everybody knows who that is. If you're identified by just one letter, you're pretty famous. Coach K, uneasy as season in pandemic unfolds. Coach K openly pondering the moral dilemma of playing college basketball during an uncontrolled pandemic. And then there's USA Today. Here's the first headline I saw. Ravaged by COVID-19, desperate for vaccine. The next final hurdle. We're going to see Thursday the authorization of vaccines for the U.S., some Americans may get their first shots this weekend. Another, playing college hoops now, madness amid COVID-19. This famous columnist wrote this article. Her name is Christine Brennan, and she begins by asking, why are we playing college basketball right now? The pandemic is raging across the country, killing thousands of Americans and filling hospitals to capacity. What is wrong with our colleges and universities? What's wrong with us? Even the Wall Street Journal. Asia grapples with rise in cases. Some Asian countries that have been among the world's most successful at containing COVID-19 are now struggling to beat back a winter resurgence. I could go on. So many headlines, and all of them are inundating us with panic with respect to the coronavirus. This coronavirus is an object lesson for discerning truth and for exercising discernment skills. 20 years ago, I wrote a book called The Millennium Bug Debugged, and I did that because back then people from across the spiritual spectrum were hyping a technological pandemic that pretended the end of civilization as we know it. Now, the advantage I had over the current pandemic is that there was a discernible before and after back then. 20 years ago, by January 1, 2000, you could know beyond the peradventure of a doubt whether so-called experts had been right or wrong, whether mass hysteria was warranted or not. If you remember back then, formidable intellects across the Christian landscape were busily propagating reckless rumors, spurious statistics, anecdotal arguments. And although painful, the January issue of Esquire gave a glimpse of what the world thought about the lack of truthfulness in the Christian camp. Leaders within Christianity were being castigated by the secular press for mining the subjunctive, for cultivating the seed of threat buried inside each unrealized instance. And today, secular media is doing the very same thing they accused Christian leaders of doing. They're using COVID-19 as a pretext for selling fear, for engaging in sloppy journalism, for employing subtly deceptive reasoning, even for trafficking in self-styled science. With self-righteous zeal, they have weaponized media channels to communicate a narrative that is, at best, the skin of the truth stuffed with copious deceptions. Now, today's podcast is going to revolve around a book titled The Price of Panic, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe. In this book, there's a trio of scholars, a biologist, a statistician, and a philosopher, and they are providing, through the pages of this book, much-needed perspective on the worst pandemic-induced disaster in history. Let me repeat that. Because actually, it's not the worst pandemic-induced disaster in history, it's the worst panic-induced disaster in history. And one of the authors of the book, Dr. Jay Richards, joins me for what is certain to be an enormously enlightening conversation. I can say that because I've had Dr. Jay Richards on many times, both on the Bible Answer Man broadcast and the Hank Unplugged podcast. Jay Richards is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute. He holds a PhD with honors in philosophy and theology from Princeton Theological University. He's the author of all kinds of books, including one of my favorites, Money, Greed, and God, The Christian Case for Free Enterprise. He also wrote another instructive book. We did an article in the Christian Research Journal on it. It's titled The Human Advantage, The Future of American Works in an Age of Smart Machines. And at the beginning of this year, 2020, we featured another of his books, Eat, Fast, Feast, Heal Your Body While Feeding Your Soul, A Christian Guide to Fasting. His new book, which is co-authored with Douglas Axe and William Briggs, is The Price of Panic, again, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe. And Jay, with all of that as prologue, I am just delighted to have you on Hank Unplugged again.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Hank. Thanks so much.
Your book has received reviews and plaudits from all kinds of very significant people. I was thinking about a New York Post columnist who wrote that your book is entertaining prose, surprising insight, and an engrossing account of how a handful of so-called experts with bad track records, dubious modeling, and no data convinced world leaders to shut down the economy. This book, she says, exposes the expert media industrial complex and confirms the lesson that nothing spreads like fear. I was talking in the beginning of this podcast as I was introducing what we're going to be talking about today, about the book I wrote, The Millennium Bug Debugged. And a lot of the same things that I wrote about back then, 20 years ago, you're writing about today with respect to COVID-19.
You're exactly right. And I mean, I can remember that was actually early on when I had just left graduate school as at Discovery Institute. And I remember even amongst those of us at Discovery Institute, some of us were terrified. Some were more skeptical. I was actually kind of the house skeptic. I don't know exactly why. It's not like I knew a lot about computer technology. But, you know, I mean, I think part of it was just the hype, honestly, at the time that, you know, that human beings, if you look historically, we are social creatures. And we're sort of tempted by hype. I mean, that's what interests us. That's what interests us in the media. Nobody wants to read a story that says 330 million Americans are still alive today, just like yesterday. I mean, right? That's a very boring story, but it's something that's sort of shocking or that, you know, pretends to change what we're used to. That's exciting. And so we have these kind of historical events. The famous Dutch tulip panic is the one that everyone talks about, or that sort of animal spirits in which things just kind of get away from rational sort of thinking when it comes to, say, stock market ups and downs. And so we always, I think, have to be aware of that. And we also have to be aware of the natural incentives of the media. It is to hype. It is to create fear and panic, but precisely because it draws more eyeballs. And so I think if we're not careful about, as you said earlier, sort of exercising discernment as consumers of media, constantly reminding ourselves, okay, they have an incentive to terrify me. So, you know, I need to look more deeply. And unfortunately, most of us don't do that. And so we're just kind of carried along. And that's really what I think the story of 2020 is going to be about. Yes, it's about a viral contagion. It's about a new coronavirus. It is dangerous, especially for certain segments of the population. But that's not a really historic event. This is sort of comparable to the Hong Kong flu of 1968, if you're going to sort of rank pandemics. This global simultaneous panic in which we just basically shut down the world, that's what people, I think, will be talking about 50 years from now.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about a couple of things as you're speaking. One is the headlines that I read. You know, that was just this morning, but I've been reading those headlines every single morning for, you know, the duration of this year. So there's been this move towards selling fear. And as you just pointed out, selling fear sells. But talk about realistically the contrast between COVID-19 and pandemics of the past. You write about this in your book.
We do, and we do our best to try to compare basically all the historical pandemics. And of course, if you are willing to go back a few thousand years and you talk in terms of the percentage of the population, there are just some horrific pandemics. Of course, the one that we're most familiar with usually is the Black Death, the plague, because, you know, in Europe, it wiped out something like a third of the population in a fairly short period of time. Now, that's civilization affecting, obviously. It like marks, you know, basically an inflection point in history. The worst thing in the 20th century was the Spanish flu of 1917. We don't know exactly how many people it killed, but something between 40 or 50 million people globally. But of course, that was when the population was much smaller. So that's really bad. I mean, if you look back, President Woodrow Wilson at the time, it turns out, didn't even actually mention it. So in terms of kind of a historic event, it only kind of made a ripple politically, but it certainly affected the world and it certainly affected the lives of millions of people. What's interesting is that the original projection for the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 in March, it was based on a computer model out of the Imperial College London. And the modelers assumed that the bug was about as deadly as the Spanish flu, but they didn't have a basis for that, but they assumed a so-called infection fatality rate of 3.4%, which would mean that basically 3.4% of everyone that got it would end up dying from it. Now, that would have been catastrophic if that had been the case, and if we had evidence to believe that. The problem is, but through a kind of comedy of errors and people not knowing what they're talking about, it's really kind of a depressing story to recount. We ended up with these public policy responses, not just in the U.S., but in most of the countries of the world. And it was a response that it sort of would have made sense in terms of the panic if the bug had been 50 or 100 times more deadly than it actually is. Now, the question is whether things like lockdowns really are a good measure or a good method either way. But at least what you want is a public policy response to be appropriate to the risk, to be appropriate to the danger. It's a sort of proverbial, you don't want to chop off your head to solve a migraine headache. And that's the problem. That's what got us worried, honestly, why we bothered to write a book starting in late March, because we realized we're making decisions globally based on a computer model that we have absolutely no reason to believe is true. And we learned within a month that it was almost completely useless for really predicting the outcome of what was going to happen in 2020.
You talk about what's going on worldwide. During the course of my ministry, I've spent a good deal of time in Taiwan. And one of the things I noticed in going to Taiwan is people routinely wear masks. If someone has the flu or someone has a cold, they out of courtesy put on a mask. However, they don't panic. The government doesn't panic because they've been through this before with SARS and with other viruses in the past. And so when coronavirus comes along, or with COVID-19, they don't lock down. They don't shut down their economy. And they've fared very, very well. I don't know if the statistic is still true. I read the statistic in your book, I think it was in March, where they only had 7 deaths. I looked on Johns Hopkins' website yesterday, and the total number of deaths is still at 7.
That's crazy. Well, what's weird about it, Hank, is that my co-author, William Briggs, is a New Yorker. He lives in New York City, but he does a lot of statistics consulting, and he happened to be doing statistics consulting for the healthcare system in Taiwan when this thing broke out. And so he got over there and really couldn't leave. They would have let him leave, but he couldn't get back to the United States. So we wrote this entire book with him in Taiwan. But he said, just what you said, that the Taiwanese, and this is true generally in East Asia, they're really quick to put masks on, you know, for whatever reason, they just tend to do that. And it's in part, it's a sort of signal to people that, okay, I'm sick right now, so sort of keep your distance. And that's part of what it is. But he said there was no panic. There was nothing like what we would think of as a lockdown. Now, we're convinced that the East Asians fared well, almost certainly because they had some kind of pre-existing immunity. I mean, there's really nothing you can say about the public policies. Japan didn't lock down as we would consider it. Taiwan, Vietnam has had virtually zero deaths. And so we suspect that that population has just been exposed to coronaviruses that were similar enough to this one that they had some pre-existing immunity. But it is interesting that, you know, most of them didn't do these kind of draconian lockdowns, and yet they did just fine. The difficulty is that there's all these different variables, because you have island countries and you have big continent-wide countries like the U.S., and you've got different climates. And so we try to work through all that statistically in the book to try to get a handle on really these big questions. One, do lockdowns really make a difference? And two, what are the main variables that determine whether a population is going to do well or do poorly when confronted with this virus?
You talk about pre-existing immunity, and I was thinking as you're talking about the elderly, I think somewhere in your book you note that the elderly may even have an advantage because of this pre-existing immunity built up over the years.
Yeah, that's right. It's sort of a paradox when it comes to flu, because, of course, influenza, we get these different strains. And so the older you are, the more likely it is that you will have lived through a really bad flu season. So if you're 70 years old, for instance, well, you lived through the Hong Kong flu. And if you're, you know, in your 70s, you actually would have gotten through the Asian flu in 1957, 1958. That was actually much worse than the Hong Kong flu. And so you made it through 2 flu pandemics. And so even if you get a really bad flu season, you're actually going to be more likely to fare well with respect to that, just the fact that it's an unusual flu. Of course, that has to be balanced by the fact that the older you get, the more comorbidities you have, the weaker your immune system is. And so the more likely it is that you'll ultimately meet your demise with some kind of combination of, say, the flu and the pneumonia. But yeah, the truth of the matter is, because we get these pandemic flus just, you know, and maybe once a decade or once every couple of decades, if you're really young, you won't have actually built up immunity to those weird flu bugs. Whereas if you've been through a couple, that's actually an advantage.
I want to get your perspective on the Great Barrington Declaration.
Those guys are exactly right. I mean, honestly, the Great Barrington Declaration, in fact, Jay Bhattacharya at Stanford and Martin Kulsdorf and some of these, the three that initially wrote the Great Barrington Declaration, and then the many scientists and scholars that signed on to it. We actually talk about some of their early work in the book, because Jay Bhattacharya at Stanford was one of several people actually at Stanford Medical School that were really challenging the idea that lockdowns were the way to go. The Great Barrington Declaration basically said lockdowns are an incorrect response, because you don't punish and lock down everyone across the population. We know that the coronavirus is much, much more dangerous for people over 70 that have several pre-existing health conditions. And so they basically argue for focused protection. So in other words, we should use all of our energy and our resources focusing our protection on those people that are most vulnerable, and then doing what we've always done before, which is to quarantine the sick. People are under a misconception that what we're doing this year is a quarantine. But a quarantine has been for centuries, you take the people that you know are sick and infectious, and you isolate them from everyone else, and then you try to isolate the people that are especially vulnerable. What we've done this year is lock down the entire population across different demographics, regardless of what sort of actual risks the virus actually holds for them. That's a really different and untested thing. The population lockdown was, it's really basically a hypothesis that's worked its way through the public health bureaucracies during the 2000s. It didn't get tried in 2009 during the swine flu. It was really just kind of a hypothesis waiting to be tested. It just turns out that 2020 was the first time when we could test this. The computer model that I mentioned earlier at Imperial College London, it assumed as one of its assumptions, it's one of its propositions, that lockdowns work. And so it basically said, well, if you do a lockdown, it actually is going to reduce the spread, so therefore we should use lockdowns. But of course, that was an assumption of the model. It hadn't yet been tested. And so the human race ended up being guinea pigs for the testing of the lockdown as a response to respiratory virus in 2020, unfortunately.
Now, your comments, you just hit home with me, because I turned 70 July 18th of this year. I have pre-existing conditions because I've been fighting cancer for about 4 years. I'm now cancer-free. But I, quite frankly, Jay, during this entire pandemic, I've flown across the country. I've continued living my life. I mean, I'm not reckless, but I don't want to be herded into a pen and stop living my life, stop interacting with my grandkids and my kids, and stop doing what I've been called to do in ministry. I think we can end up putting so much emphasis on fear that we stop living the lives that God has given us to live in the present.
I think that's exactly right. I honestly think, Hank, that part of the reason it was so easy to get us to comply is that we weren't told we needed to do this for our own good. We were told we needed to do it for others. And that's honestly why I think that public health emergencies are kind of going to be the tool of choice in the future for people that want to take away our basic liberties. Because, you know, I mean, we all heard the argument, look, okay, Jay, maybe you'll be fine, but if you're asymptomatic and you're a carrier and you go to church, you might spread it to someone who's really vulnerable, right? And then they would get sick and maybe even die. And so you need to do this for them. Well, of course, that's true all the time. I mean, that's true when it comes to the flu. It's true when it comes to any infectious disease. And what we normally do is we tell people, okay, we're in the middle of flu and cold season, and we count on people to use their local knowledge to decide, okay, am I at risk? If so, how much risk am I willing to take? And that's how we sort of handle these things. And we actually think that actually the only kind of real benefit of social distancing that happened in the spring happened already as soon as people started hearing about the virus. We do different things based upon new information. We think people probably exercised more precaution based on their local knowledge. And then when the government-imposed lockdowns came down, they just made no difference so far as we could tell in looking at the data. And so this is the sort of ironies. I mean, at least now we actually have the dates. We know when different states locked down. We have the case curves. We have the death and hospitalization curves. And so we can actually kind of run the test and say, okay, did the lockdowns make a difference? Unfortunately, here we are in December, and so many people, including public health officials, just aren't willing to really talk about, okay, what have we learned? The virtue of the Great Barrington Declaration, scientists and doctors, is they said, well, let's look at the data and focus on that and pivot based upon what we know. Let's not keep trying this thing that we know not only doesn't work, but it actually, I think, and many of them think, does more harm than good.
What is the relationship between lockdowns and the cost of lockdowns? In other words, I don't know whether I got this from your book or not, I just can't remember, but the cost of lockdowns in the United States alone is about $1 trillion per month. Yes. And we have just instituted in North Carolina, for example, a partial lockdown. So we know that lockdowns really don't work, and yet we also know that there is an extraordinary cost associated with lockdowns.
That's right. It's $1 trillion a month is the figure that we came up with. I can tell you there was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears coming up to that number because we wanted to figure out, okay, obviously the pandemic itself would have had a cost on its own. And so we needed to figure out what's the cost of the panic and in particular the lockdowns. And that is our estimate that the lockdowns cost the U.S. about $1 trillion every month. And that's not just dollars. That's lives and well-being, of course. The problem is that so many people tended to think that the question was between lives on one side and dollars on the other. I mean, Dr. Anthony Fauci said, well, I realize this is going to be an inconvenience, but we just have to do it. It's almost like they treat it as a one-sided risk, as if their lives are at stake only on one side. But the reality is their lives at stake either way. If millions of people lose their jobs, if millions of people aren't able to go in for cancer screenings, that costs lives too. And I'm just amazed at how many officially smart people just simply didn't think of that. I mean, Melinda Gates apparently just yesterday in an interview, and of course she and Bill Gates have been sort of big advocates for the lockdown, she said, you know, the one thing we really didn't count on or think about was kind of the economic consequences of this. Well, that's exactly what I was thinking of, because economics matters not because money matters, it matters because people matter. And doing things that just destroy the economy are going to cost people's lives. And that's honestly what persuaded me, okay, we got to write a book about this just so we can at least hopefully slow down or prevent us from making the same mistake twice.
You know, there are a lot of negative things said about the Gates, but one of the things I always think about when I think of them is what they're doing for the poor and the downtrodden. And in concert with what you just said, when the West locks down, it negatively affects the poorest of the poor around the globe.
That's right. I mean, in many ways, we spend most of the time in the book on just the domestic situation in the U.S. because we feel like that's what we have the most influence over. But if you look at the U.N. food program, so the irony here is the World Health Organization that sort of led the lockdown fever, part of the U.N. Well, the U.N. food program is the arm that looks at basically starvation and nutrition around the world. They estimate that just the shock to the global food supply chain because of the lockdowns could end up by the end of 2020. So we're there now, costing something like 300,000 extra deaths from starvation every single day, right? So that, and we're there now. Now, we won't know how accurate that is until 2021, but even if it's only 30,000, right, 30,000 excess deaths of starvation every single day just from a shock to the global food supply, that is to the global economy of food, that's a devastating cost. And this is not, you know, if you read news stories about this, they'll always talk about it as if it's a cost of the pandemic. It is not a cost of the pandemic. It's a cost of our response to the pandemic. And that's absolutely crucial to keep that distinction in mind.
You've already touched on this, but what's keeping us in a panic? Your book is titled The Price of Panic, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe. But what is keeping us in the state of panic?
I think a lot of it is just incentives. I mean, I don't think that this is the result of millions of nefarious people wanting to harm their fellow human beings. I think most people sort of think they're doing the right thing, but I think part of it is that the media is so invested in this that at this point now to all of a sudden start making crucial distinctions. For instance, distinguishing positive tests, because we do 1.5 million tests every day, distinguishing that from cases that require hospitalization, right? Well, they should have been making that distinction all along. If they did it now, they'd be basically, it would be indicting the way they've reported this before. Starting to talk about the fact that the flu seems to have disappeared, probably because things that are being counted as COVID deaths now are actually, they're essentially cannibalizing what would have been other types of deaths in other years. So they can't really talk about that. They're sort of invested in it. And then, frankly, you've got lots of politicians who are all in on the lockdowns. And so it would look sort of strange for them to suddenly reverse course. And so you get this weird situation where you have lots of politicians claiming to be making decisions on the science, even though more and more of the scientists are speaking up and saying there's really no scientific justification for closing schools, for instance. Kids, there's very little evidence that they ever transmit this to each other. This idea of asymptomatic spread is probably not anything like what we thought it was. And even when kids get it, they're at much more risk of death from the flu than they are from COVID-19. That's just, you read that straight from the CDC numbers. And so at some point, something's got to give, because we can't stay in a panic state indefinitely. We can't do that physiologically. But I just think so many people in the media and in politics are so invested in this panic narrative, in this what we call panic porn, that they're just having a hard time kind of winding it down, unfortunately.
You think about narratives, and immediately comes to my mind the statement by Governor Andrew Cuomo, who said rather irrationally, if everything we do saves just one life, I'd be happy. So if we save one life by a lockdown, it's worth it. It's worth it, even if the collateral damage of a lockdown is far worse in terms of lost lives. Now, when I hear someone say something like that, I think, well, on the one hand, you can think he's nefarious. On the other hand, you can think, well, sorry for saying it this way, but he's just dumb.
And I honestly, I would pick that second hypothesis. I really don't think he realized what he was saying, because it was clear is that he's assuming, again, that this is a one-sided risk. So everything we do, if it saves one life, he's not imagining that there could be lives lost as a result of the response. He's assuming that there could only be lives lost as a result of the coronavirus. But of course, anyone that spent 10 seconds thinking about this and understands that every decision involves trade-offs is going to realize, look, if we basically clear out the hospital wards, we cancel all scheduled procedures and screenings in all the hospitals around the country, you know what? There are other sicknesses and forms of death that are going to continue going on. That policy itself is going to kill people. And so the rational public policy response is always going to say, okay, what are all the risks? How does this risk compare with that? And what's the kind of best way to reduce the risk from COVID-19 without creating other problems on the other side? But with Governor Cuomo, it was like there was just absolutely no thinking like this. And we're still in this stage of delusion. You know, he got this international Emmy a couple of weeks ago for communicating science on the airwaves, when in fact, not only did he not think clearly about it, but he's the one that, of course, ordered that nursing home patients that caught the coronavirus in hospitals got moved back into the nursing homes, which is literally what you would do if you wanted to kill people. It's not why he did that, of course, but you couldn't have done it any better if that had actually been the goal. And so there still really hasn't been a reckoning where people said, look, I made terrible mistakes, and the media said, okay, we misunderstood this. It still hasn't happened.
Many powerful institutions, as you point out, push diversity, except when it comes to diversity of viewpoint. And so unless you go lockstep along with the herd, you are shouted down immediately. I mean, I've seen this over and over again during the course of this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's what's so odd about this, because very often, you know, we're talking about a so-called scientific consensus, but there was never anything like a consensus either on how deadly this virus is going to be or on the benefits of lockdowns. The scientists at the Great Barrington Declaration, many of them in March were saying, this is a really bad idea. This is untested. We need to look at this. But what happened, this is what we call the tyranny of experts, by the way. The problem isn't expertise. It's that you have these public health bureaucracies. You have it at the international level with the World Health Organization. And then, of course, you have every country has its own public health bureaucracy. And it's populated with public health officials that may be scientists, they may be medical doctors. The media treated them as if, well, if you're a public health official, then that's sort of like winning the gold medal of scientific expertise. And so whatever you said, that was the gospel with respect to the science. It didn't matter if there was a really smart, credentialed scientist, say, from Stanford that disagreed with you, because he was independent of the government. He wasn't an official in the public health bureaucracy. And that was the serious problem. The problem wasn't that the president has scientists advising him. It's that he has just a few scientists, and they all happen to work for the federal government, happen to have been inherited as part of the kind of permanent administrative state, when what the president and governors needed was really access to the full range of scientific opinion from the very beginning. And most of them didn't have that. I can say Governor DeSantis in Florida went out of his way to do that. He contacted scientists in Europe, and he figured out very quickly, okay, this is really dangerous to the elderly, especially in nursing homes. It's not so dangerous for children. And so they did a partial lockdown, and then they did focus protection. But he basically did what I think every politician in the future ought to do, which is make sure you have access to some scientists that are outside the government bureaucracy so that they're free to tell you exactly what they think. They're not bound by the incentives of being part of the government structure.
It's safe to say that your book, The Price of Panic, is a non-alarmist model that turns out to be right as we look back. But you were right in the wrong direction. What's the cost of being right, but in the wrong direction?
Well, this is the problem, and this is the kind of distinction we make in the book, is wrong in the right direction. You can get scientific accolades in the public health community, and in fact, you can continue to go on to greater and greater things. So Neil Ferguson, who is the head scientist, part of a team of 30 that developed this Imperial College London model, we go back over 20 years, he has never gotten a prediction right when it came to a pandemic. In fact, he's just been catastrophically wrong every single time. But the natural incentive, if you're in public health and you think about it, your job is to advise politicians, and you have to tell a prime minister, okay, this virus is just going to kill 100 people. Let's say you say that, and then it kills 10,000 people. Well, you're going to be looking for another job. But what if you say, well, it's going to kill 1 million people unless you you know, sort of implement these draconian measures. And then you do, and then it kills a lot fewer people. First, people will say, well, good, I'm glad it wasn't as bad as we thought it would be. Or they'll say, oh, I'm sure glad we took your advice because we prevented all those deaths. In other words, nobody ever goes back and actually checks the original numbers. And that's what happened with Neil Ferguson, whether it was SARS and swine flu or a bird flu, mad cow disease. Over and over again, he would get this wrong by many, many, many orders of magnitude, and he never suffered any consequences. On the other hand, if you're in the position like us, which is to say, okay, look, let's figure out how dangerous this bug actually is so that we know how best to respond to it. Well, you get attacked for being a conspiracy theorist and a hoaxer who doesn't believe it's a real virus. I mean, of course, we didn't think that, but that was essentially the response, and it was the response to scientists who said, actually, the infection fatality rate is, so far as we could tell, that's not what it is. You were treated like a pariah, and that's just a very strange thing. So that basically alarmism sells and is beneficial both personally and in terms of media clicks. Non-alarmist attempts to try to calm people, it's not popular, especially when you're in the middle of a panic.
Is there any evidence that suggests that this virus was man-made?
We were perfectly open to that. I mean, I have to tell you, Hank, right at the beginning, the fact that the media said that can't be true and you're crazy if you think it made me think, okay, let's look into this because I don't trust the media. The original story was that it came from a wet market in Wuhan, in this large city in central China. I'd say looking at the details, looking at the sequence of the virus, we don't think there's any evidence that it was actually designed, because, of course, we think, you know, bioengineers could design a virus to be very deadly, but it's actually very similar to other coronaviruses we know of that are native to this particular type of bat. We know that they experiment on these bats at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. There were just basically a couple of changes that had to take place in order for it to pass to humans, but they're the kind of normal mutational changes that happen naturally. And so if it was designed, and you can't tell. It really looks very much like a natural virus that just made the jump from bats to humans. But we really do think it's much more likely that it came from that lab rather than from the wet market. That just seemed implausible to us. And just there are enough kind of indications between it being a bat virus, the Wuhan Institute of Virology being right there in the city, and then also the U.S. State Department just a couple of years ago issued a report saying they were worried about security protocols at the Wuhan Institute. And so we just think, you know, if we were going to bet, we think that it accidentally leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
Talk about social distancing. I was at Whole Foods yesterday, and you go down one aisle, and then you have to skip an aisle and go down the other aisle again, because if you go down the next aisle, you're going down the wrong way. You got to social distance. You got to stand 6 feet apart. Is there any science behind social distancing that is compelling?
Not very much, unfortunately. I mean, this was, again, a surprise to us, but we discovered this World Health Organization report, a sort of meta report, which is in 2019, October 2019, World Health Organization looked at really hundreds of scientific studies asking questions about masks, social distancing, the lockdowns, all these kind of non-pharmacological responses. And the conclusion of this World Health Organization report was that there's no solid evidence that any of these really make much difference. And then when you look at masks, at least masks as ordinary people wear them, that's the crucial point. They don't seem to make any difference. And in some cases, they might actually be counterproductive. What's really important to realize is that a lot of the things we're doing are based on the assumption that the main ways in which the virus spreads is kind of by sneezing and coughing. So sort of large, you know, spit basically coming out of our mouths when we cough. And so if you're wearing a surgical mask, that's going to stop a big globule of spit. That's really what it's designed for. So for a surgeon that's operating on someone in case he sneezes, it's going to catch large particles, but it's not designed to catch aerosols, which are these really, really fine particles that also come out even when we breathe and when we sneeze, that can hang in the air for minutes or even hours. Those pass right through those surgical masks, just like smoke. I mean, they just really don't make any difference. And so if you're going to stop that, you need to be wearing N95 masks that are really tightly fitted around your face.
No facial hair.
No facial hair. Like, I've got a little facial hair. It makes it completely ineffective because the air is just going to go right around the edge because it's hard to pull the air through that. And so that's why, you know, I actually had COVID-19. I tested positive and actually spent overnight in the hospital because my oxygen went down a little bit a few weeks ago. And I saw what the frontline workers are doing. They're wearing tightly fitted N95 masks, wearing goggles, face shields, gloves, the gloves over gowns. some of them are wearing two masks that are tightly fitted. It's really quite inconvenient. And there's just no way that people living their lives are going to be able to do that. And so the stuff we're doing sort of might make some difference for the certain kind of a big cough in which you have a bunch of spit and somebody breathes it. It probably makes no difference for aerosol transmission, which we think is actually the main way in which this is transmitted. So unless you're going to spread people out in a kind of police state and force them to wear hazmat suits, we think that most of this, unfortunately, is hygiene theater, and it's not making much difference.
We're on the cusp of a vaccine. I was reading in the paper this morning that the first vaccines may be implemented to the general populace this weekend. Is the vaccine rightly considered a shortcut to herd immunity? And maybe it's even good to talk about what herd immunity is. Maybe somebody doesn't know listening in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the idea of herd immunity is, incidentally, it's not a strategy so much as just kind of an epidemiological fact that what happens with viruses like this is that once a certain percentage of the population has gotten the bug or is immune to it, then the bug has fewer vectors, right? Fewer ways to get transmitted around. And so when you vaccinate a large segment of the population, like the flu vaccine, people often think they're doing that just for themselves. Well, when you take a flu vaccine, it's only about 30% likely to actually immunize you. But by millions of us getting it, it actually speeds up herd immunity against that particular strain of virus for that year. And so really, that's what a vaccine is. It's designed, unless it's 100% effective, one of its main uses is just to kind of speed up herd immunity. Now, these vaccines, there's one by Moderna now and one by Pfizer that are kind of the first across the finish line. Of course, they haven't gone through the normal FDA testing. We've never developed a vaccine for a coronavirus in history that's passed the FDA. And so there's just so many unknowns that I think, you know, I'm super hopeful. I mean, I hope these really do have a 90 or 95% effectiveness rate. I really hope that they're sort of low cost to taking it. That would be terrific. But at the moment, we're getting this information from the press releases of the corporations who've developed them. And so, you know, I'm just sort of suspending judgment at the moment. But the reality is, because they've really not gone through the normal testing protocols, it really wouldn't, I don't think it would be rational. If you have a 10-year-old child who's healthy, honestly, if I had a 10-year-old child, I absolutely would not have my child get that vaccine, because the risk of the COVID-19 is so low and the risk of the vaccine is really kind of an unknown. On the other hand, if you're 70 and you have comorbidities and all of your friends have gotten it and seem fine, then maybe your risk calculation is different. But this idea that everyone should have to get the vaccine, no matter what their personal risk, that just doesn't make any sense to me.
I was thinking, as you're talking about sort of what's going on in the culture, and maybe this is extreme, but I think it warrants a response. You have governors shutting down churches to some degree, or curtailing what's going on in churches, and yet leaving strip clubs open. And at first blush, that seems completely irrational, but could it be that there's some rationality behind it? Because they're thinking, well, in church you sing, and that's a way of spreading the virus, but in strip clubs, you sit there silently and watch.
I feel, my sense is that governors are just kind of shooting from the hip. I mean, in some ways, that's the most benign interpretation, is that they're thinking that way. In some cases, it seems almost so targeted toward churches. So here in the District of Columbia in Washington, D.C., I can tell you, Costco, they're limiting the numbers of people. It's always packed with people, and you can still buy as much liquor as you want in the Costco in D.C. where they sell liquor. But the National Basilica of the Immaculate Conception in Washington, D.C., right by Catholic University campus where I teach, okay, it can seat, Hank, 6,000 people. This is one of the largest buildings in the world. It's enormous. And District of Columbia allows 50 people to go in there at one time, which is, it's just laughable. And it's very hard for me to think of a rational reason for that. It looks very much to me like essentially politicians are just sort of deciding, oh, that's not important. People don't need to go to church. But of course, they need to get liquor at Costco. So, I mean, it's essentially reflecting their particular priorities, which tend to be overwhelmingly left-wing and secular, unfortunately.
We're involved in this multi-trillion dollar social experiment. And it's so interesting to me because you sort of have a whipsaw. You hear someone saying one thing one month and then something completely different the next month. So I'm thinking, for example, the Surgeon General, Jerome Adams, who wrote back at the beginning of the coronavirus, seriously, people, stop buying masks. They're not effective in preventing general public from catching coronavirus. So he is telling us not to wear masks. Don't buy them. Don't wear them. And now we're told that if we walk into a store without a mask, if we walk into a church without a mask, we're putting the populace in danger.
I mean, it's the craziest thing, and all of us remember that, but it's amazing how few people actually still realize the cognitive dissonance. I think people imagine that there have been these major new studies that somehow prove that masks work, when nothing's changed on this. In fact, all the data is basically the same as it's always been. At best, I would say it's ambiguous. But what was really weird about the messaging at the very beginning is they would say, people don't buy masks and don't wear them. They don't work. And if you buy them, you'll prevent healthcare workers from having them, which is really bizarre because that implies they work, right? I mean, now what they could have said is, unless these masks are worn properly and constantly changed and you've been trained in it, they're going to not make any difference. And so let the people that, since there's a shortage of them, let the people that are really at risk and know how to wear them, leave them for them. That would have been treating us like adults. So they essentially would not treat us like adults. And so what, you know, for all intents and purposes, they went from telling us absolutely don't wear a mask, they don't work, to absolutely have to wear a mask because they'll save everyone. And, you know, it's funny, though, because people have, for the most part, at least I'd say maybe half the population has complied. And if you were to believe polls, half the population is still terrified. Even in December, we're still basically have the same views that we had in March. And I think maybe half the population is realizing, okay, there's more to this.
Talk about outdoors. I like to play golf. And I remember after going to the Levine Cancer Center here in Charlotte to see my oncologist, the one thing that he was urging me to do is to wear a mask if I play golf.
This makes absolutely no sense. I mean, the reality is that we know certain things about respiratory viruses. And so, for instance, an aerosol that can be suspended in the air, it'll suspend in the air inside. But if you're outside, the air is constantly circulating, besides which, you know, outside is open at the top. There's not a roof over us. And so the air dissipates greatly. And if there's any sunshine, UV radiation kills viruses that are suspended in the air. And so really the safest place you can be is for, you know, most functions is outside. And so this idea that if you're anywhere, you're not going to wear a mask, it's outside. It never made any sense to me at all. And this really just requires that people not think about the kind of details of the virus. I mean, because honestly, most people that are doing this, they're smart enough to be able to figure this out. It's just that the problem is that when we're in a panic, when we're in fear, we kind of got this fight or flight response, and it just kind of overrides our rational capacity, which requires us to deliberate on these things. And so, you know, I feel sad. I see in my neighborhood, I mean, people will be driving around in their cars by themselves, still wearing masks. And so this is it's a very strange thing, especially more than anything, I worry about the effect that this is going to have on young children who are constantly seeing this, constantly being trained in their muscle memories to think about their fellow human beings, not as neighbors and people to love, creatures made in the image of God, but as sort of vectors for an infectious disease that might kill them. That just can't be good long term.
Talk about the NFL for a moment. I was watching an NFL game this past weekend, and it just seems like it's a case study in cognitive dissonance. You have players on top of one another on the field, no masks, and then you look at the sidelines and you see everybody wearing masks. In fact, if the coaches don't wear masks, they are subject to hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines. I mean, that seems to be a picture on your television that just tells you this is crazy.
Yeah, these are hints that maybe a lot of the people that are telling us we have to do this don't even really believe it themselves. It's like Governor Newsom, you know, in California, who told everyone they can't do anything, and then he's hanging out inside with friends without a mask at fancy restaurants. They managed to do both of these things. And it's funny with the NFL, of course, those guys on the field, they are not at risk. These are people at the very peak of their health and conditioning. They're all fairly young. You know, these guys, even if they are COVID positive, are very unlikely to get sick. And the reality is, especially if you're in a stadium outside, that's one of the safer things you can do. I mean, that's the irony, Hank. I mean, the reason that there's a cold and flu season in the Northern Hemisphere is because that's when, you know, it gets cold, and that's when we go inside and we're congregating inside and we sort of spread our air around each other. That's why it happens at a particular time. Now, we had a double spike with COVID-19. Both first it started in New York in the north, and then it hit later in the south. But that was because, unlike the flu, it hit just in January, whereas the flu has already worked its way through the population by the late spring normally because it started in the winter. And so what happened is that COVID-19, or rather the coronavirus, was working its way through the population. In the south in the spring, you know, people are outside. They're in North Carolina. They're playing golf. you get to July and you live in Arizona or Florida, you're spending a heck of a lot more time inside in dry air. And so it was essentially the same kind of conditions, dry inside air and a new virus. And so that's why we think you got the spike in the deep south in the summer, because they were really encountering it for the first time.
So talk about the place for civil disobedience. You know, you go into church, and I've heard this myself. I've been at various churches, pastors, preachers, priests, that telling you that you have to obey the governing authorities. You got to do this. This is the right thing to do. Where's the place where we say, no, I'm not going to do this anymore? Where's that line?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's ultimately, it is a prudential judgment, but I just think of, you know, what Martin Luther King said in his letter from Birmingham jail, quoting Thomas Aquinas, is that an unjust law is no law at all, because the law is ultimately, the positive law is the kind of human written laws that are ultimately supposed to reflect our natures and the natural law that God has created. And so if something is just genuinely unjust, then I think you can ask yourself, as a Christian, you could say, okay, when is it appropriate to resist? And sometimes resistance actually causes you personal suffering. I think when we were in a situation, say in March, in which maybe people thought incorrectly, but they could be forgiven for thinking this is really deadly, we need to have a kind of temporary freeze in place process, and it was applied indiscriminately. So in other words, it applied to kind of everyone across the board, then you could at least say, okay, this is being applied in a balanced way. Unfortunately, very quickly, what happened is that churches started getting singled out. So we're suddenly put in the inessential category, or somehow it's much worse to be in church, as you said, than to be in some other group setting. Now, that at that point, that starts to become unjust precisely because it's discriminatory. And so that's why, for instance, John MacArthur's church, I think, in California did this. Capital Baptist here in Washington, D.C. did this. They basically went to court and said, the law is not being applied consistently. You're singling out churches, and that's a violation of our First Amendment rights to religion. And truth of the matter is, almost every time this has happened, the judges have ruled in favor of the people complaining and against the government. Because the reality is that governors in states and cities, they have this police emergency power for about 30 days usually. And so if there's a tsunami or something and they need to use it. But that discretion to just be able to lock people down is very short-lived. And in almost every case, we're out many, many months now. And the justification for this, I think, is long since passed. I really do think we're now at the stage where this is just going to keep happening until we decide we're not going to comply. And by not comply, I don't mean violence. I mean just simply refusing to do it, simply refusing to close your business or refusing to close your church, taking all necessary precautions, of course, but just simply refusing to comply. When that happens, I think a lot of these lockdowns and policies, they go away because there's really no way to enforce them unless basically everyone complies with them, which is what's happening right now.
Are the vaccines going to make all of this just be a distant memory? It'll all go away in a very short period of time, so let's not obsess over it.
Well, I would hope so, except that if you look at the news and you look at Dr. Fauci and public health authorities, they're saying the vaccines, even though we're being told it may be a 95% effectiveness, which would be amazing, we're still being told, now this won't be the end of it because we'll still need to maintain social distancing, we'll still need to wear masks, we're not going to ever return to normal. No shaking hands, we're going to have to adjust to the so-called new normal. And so that's what's sort of terrifying, because I think a lot of us were comforting ourselves thinking, okay, well, at least when we get a vaccine, that could be a sort of fig leaf that will be a justification to go back to normal. All the public health officials are basically telling us, no, it's not going to happen. And so I don't think we should, you know, even in the best case scenario with the vaccine, that shouldn't comfort us into thinking, okay, let's just hold out, it'll be fine. I think, honestly, if we don't start resisting this in appropriate ways, I think that this could be the new normal, and we don't want it.
You just mentioned the word resisting, and it reminds me of what Benjamin Franklin said when he said, rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. Parse that out for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, essentially, this is a long sort of standing part of the Christian tradition. Of course, we know about Romans 13. We know about the sort of the requirement that we're supposed to obey laws, including laws that maybe we don't necessarily like. Maybe you think that a 25-mile-an-hour zone is unjustified. It should be 35 miles an hour. I have that thought pretty much every day in Washington, D.C., but it's not an intrinsically unjust law. And so I think all things being equal, we should comply with those. And even in this spring with many of these rules that I thought this doesn't make any sense, but it's not necessarily unjust initially. But if you are told you're not allowed to go to church, you're not allowed to go to mass, and when you ask for the sort of justification for this, you're told, well, there's a virus out there And it turns out the infection fatality rate of this virus is comparable to the Hong Kong flu or something like that when we didn't lock anything down. Well, now at this point, this very justification for essentially curtailing your right to worship, your right to exercise your religion, it's just lacking. There's not a just justification for that. And that's, I think, what we need to, we're going to have to make that kind of calculation. But as long as we believe, for instance, like this COVID tracking poll in July asked Americans what percentage of the population they thought had died of COVID-19. Now, this was just in July, so it had only been going a few months. The average American guessed 9%. So they thought 9% of the population had been killed by COVID-19. Well, the right answer at the time was 0.06%. So the average American thought this virus was 150 times more deadly than it actually is. Now, we got that impression not from the CDC website, but from the media and from our social media feeds, I assume. And so we just completely overestimated the dangers. As long as we think that, we might think these laws are just. But when we realize, wait, this is completely out of proportion to anything else that anybody has ever responded to a pandemic in this way, then I think we're going to assess these rules differently.
When I was reading through your book, I pay attention to details, and one of the epigraphs was by Thomas Sowell. He's not just one of my favorite economists, he's just one of my favorite people. And he said in this epigraph, there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. And that seems to apply to this situation in a particular and peculiar way.
Absolutely, because, I mean, the lockdowns, for instance, that the way that they applied to hospitals. So the assumption was that the hospital system was going to get slammed with COVID-19 patients. That was a justification for the flattening the curve idea that we all saw, that image of the spiky curve without lockdowns and then the smushed flatter curve with lockdowns. The idea is we just do this for a couple of weeks so that we don't overwhelm the healthcare system. But we also use that as a justification essentially to cancel everything else out that was happening. And as a result of that now, it looks like, according to one study, there'll be about 80,000 missed cancer screenings just in that first 3 months of the lockdown. So in other words, people who their cancer would have been caught if they'd been going in for their test or even just their general, you know, sort of annual physical, got missed. And some percentage of those people will either have a much worse fight with cancer, and then some of them will die as a result of that. That's the real cost. That's why always from the beginning, when you're thinking about public health response, you have to think in terms of trade-offs. Because, I mean, President Trump was right about this right at the beginning. He said, we don't want the cure to be worse than the disease. He had this kind of intuition that shutting everything down is going to have all these spin-off effects, these unintended consequences, and we need to try to anticipate that. And unfortunately, in general, public health officials just seemed almost completely incapable of doing this. Dr. Fauci, who I think, you know, he knows his stuff when he's talking about immunology, he showed himself to be just a classic technocrat when it came to really thinking through the costs and the benefits of a particular policy.
Yeah, I couldn't look at the big picture. Are hospitals really being slammed? I mean, that's what I'm reading in the newspaper even this morning, that hospitals are being slammed. And so we have to take these lockdown precautions seriously, partial lockdown precautions as in North Carolina, because the hospitals are being overwhelmed again. We were told that this was going to happen in New York. You had ships in the harbor that afforded beds. You had all kinds of hospital beds being built by the military, but they went unused. We're
That's
hearing
right.
the same story again. Is it true this time?
It's basically the same story as it was before. And so but the first question, Hank, that people ought to ask is, okay, what normally happens this time of year in hospitals and ICUs? If you actually look at that, you always want to ask yourself, what's the baseline, right? Like how many people in general die at a particular time? This time of year, this is a cold and flu season, and hospitals get their capacity pushed. In fact, Hank, about a year, almost 2 years ago now, I fell down the stairs in our townhouse, and we lived in the townhouse in D.C., ruptured my quad tendon on my left leg, had to be dragged down four flights of stairs in a stretcher, and the first two hospitals turned me away when I was in the ambulance. I finally got to the third one. It was really crowded, just sat on a stretcher for hours before I could get a room, and I asked the nurse, okay, what's happening? And she said, you don't want to get hurt on the first Friday of the month in Washington, D.C. It's like, why? She said, oh, that's when a lot of people cash their checks, they get drunk, and they end up in the emergency room. And so, you see, ER doctors, they all knew that, right? But none of us knew that. most of us don't think about what's actually happening. So what's happening right now is what tends to happen with a respiratory virus season. We've got it's cold and flu season. Now it's cold and flu and COVID-19 season. So there are an increase in hospitalizations, but it's not really different from what we had before. And as you noted, in New York, we not only had a naval ship that was parked right off the edge of Manhattan, we had the Javits Center with thousands of hospital beds that were not used. We had secondary structures that were built in many hospitals that were not used. And so you want to get the facts on this right. And then the final thing is that people are assuming, okay, let's say the hospitals are being pressured with really strong cases. Why do you think the lockdowns work? We still haven't gotten to that question because we're still assuming that lockdowns actually make a difference. But we know, we absolutely know when we look at the data now, that these imposed lockdowns on the general population don't make any discernible difference in the spread of the virus. And so they're not only a waste of time, but they end up basically punishing large numbers of people and not making a difference. But as long as that premise is there, we're going to constantly be asked to be going into lockdowns whenever we get, basically every flu season, we'll be told we've got to lock down the country. That's just crazy.
Is there a correspondence between testing and then the reports in the newspaper of the spikes that are taking place all over the world? Is that because we're doing a whole lot more testing?
Absolutely. Now, I'm not saying there aren't people getting it and that are sick with it, but then that's a real case. And so that what happened is that if you had sort of until essentially May of this year, for all of history, if you talk about cases, what a case was a person that actually was positive. So you test positive, you actually have the bug, and then you're sick enough that your symptoms are so bad that you have to be treated with medicine and maybe even go to the hospital. That's the definition of a case. Well, what happened is that we ramped up our testing. And so in the summer, we got up to 1 million tests every day. We're now up to about, believe it or not, 1.4 million tests every single day in the United States of America. Large numbers of people being tested a couple of times a week because of their job. They're asymptomatic. They test positive. Well, they are a positive test. They're not a case. But the media, when they're talking about cases, what they mean are reported positive tests. Only a subset are genuine cases. And so the media just sort of seamlessly transitioned from the meaning of a case being symptomatic to basically somebody that has a positive test. Now, lay that on top of the fact that the so-called PCR test, the way it's being used is really, in many places, very, very sensitive. It's overly sensitive. And so very often, even when you get a positive test result, you could be a false positive because it can pick up fragments of the virus. You might have had it 3 months ago. You're perfectly well. You're not symptomatic and you're not contagious. But you got a little fragment. Well, that test actually picks it up. And so statistically, this ends up being a mess. But if you do massive amounts of testing on asymptomatic people, and one of the tests you use is extremely sensitive, you're going to get a lot of positive results. That just makes perfect sense. And so that's why we think ultimately we're going to have to talk about excess deaths. We'll know those numbers about February and be able to look back and finally be able to cash out these numbers. But almost all the numbers you're hearing right now, I just advise people just kind of sit loosely on them. We'll be able to nail this stuff down. But a lot of this is unfortunately overreporting, and it's helping to kind of fuel the terror and the panic.
What's the actual statistic of how many people died as a result of some of the moves that were made early on with COVID-19, where you had hospitals supposedly inundated with COVID-19 patients, and they were worried about the overflow, and so they insisted on clearing out elderly patients, even if they were infected, and sending them to nursing homes. And so you had a large percentage of people dying in nursing homes. And so when you look at the aggregate number, if you look at the 200, I don't know what it is right now, 285,000 or 289,000 or whatever the number of deaths are, and you start calculating where most of those deaths came from, it seems like many of them came from failed government policies.
Absolutely. I mean, the fact that we have, especially nursing homes, and that's why it was so bad in New York and New Jersey. They had this really crazy policy of it'd send people from nursing homes into the hospitals. Hospitals is a place that's where a lot of people were catching it early on, and then they'd get it, and then they would send them back to the nursing homes on the assumption that, well, we're going to need that hospital bed, and then infect the rest of the people in the nursing homes, which are all the most high-risk population. And so that's why it's so heavily skewed early on, not just toward elderly deaths, but deaths in nursing homes. That was just a pure policy failure. And we were also early on overusing ventilators, unfortunately. There's no doubt in our minds that many of the deaths early on were actually caused by ventilators. They're not doing that anymore. They're much more hesitant. So the healthcare profession has sort of learned on the job on that. But that, I mean, the reality is we knew by April that the coronavirus was much, much more dangerous for elderly people with comorbidities. In fact, the average age of death, it's about 79 on average with people with 2.6 comorbidities. And by comorbidity, we don't just mean, well, that, you know, I don't know, that, you know, they have a bum knee or something. What that means is that they have illnesses that would have likely killed them fairly soon anyway. And so that's why the average age of death with COVID-19 is about the same as the average life expectancy. That's a really relevant piece of information because, of course, everyone has a limited lifespan. Everyone ultimately dies. Hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people in the United States die every year. And many, many of the people that are dying from COVID deaths are people that likely would have died from something else, probably the flu, within 6 to 9 months, even without COVID-19. Now, the point isn't that, well, if you're older, your life's not worth anything. The point is that from a public health perspective, something that is a sort of contributing factor to deaths of people right at the end of their lives, that's just a different kind of crisis from something that just wipes out people all across the age spectrum. And unfortunately, we've responded to it as if it's kind of an indiscriminate killer when it's not.
When you're talking about this, so many things go through my mind. I'm thinking about my sister right now, and she was just diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And so she's going through the battle of her life. She's had cancer before, so this is the second time around. She had breast cancer and now pancreatic cancer. But one of the tragedies for my sister is that she's taking her chemotherapy treatments in the hospital now in isolation. It used to be, and I remember when I was taking my own chemo treatments, that I would sit in the chemo chair and I'd have people to talk to. My family would be around, my wife would be around. But now if you have a treatment, you're going in isolation. If you die, you're buried in isolation. Talk about that social dynamic, which is a huge fallout factor in terms of these policies that are being made. You think, well, the policies, maybe they get it wrong, maybe they get it right, whatever. But there's this enormous emotional and spiritual and economic and all these other factors that go into how this impacts people as human beings.
Absolutely. I mean, the reality is if you're going through this in isolation, I mean, healthcare workers, there's a lot of data on the way in which social connections actually help people in terms of their health, in terms of your ability to recover. We have been following very closely because I really think the relevant statistic ultimately is going to be excess deaths for 2020. That is deaths, basically, if you were to just sort of extrapolate what happens in a normal year, then the excess deaths would be over and above that, effectively. And what we found, and we'd already started seeing the signature of this in the summer, is you're going to have some people that died that wouldn't have died because of COVID-19, but then you have all these non-COVID-19 related excess deaths. One recent study thinks that just so-called deaths of despair, so that suicide, drug and alcohol overdose, will have at least 75,000 excess deaths of despair. Well, those are deaths from the lockdowns. There'll be something like 80,000 missed cancer screenings. Now, that's just cancer. Now you add all these other things and then add just the deaths that are the result. They're sort of hard to track, but deaths from the isolation that people suffer, the elderly people who would really prefer to take their chances rather than be isolated. There's no doubt in our minds that those excess deaths as a result of the lockdowns and lockdown mentality will equal or exceed the number of deaths from COVID-19 in 2020. There's just no doubt in our mind about that.
There's so much that we can learn already. One of the things in terms of a takeaway that ought to be imprinted on the canvas of our consciousness is models, that we have to take the models and predictions with a pinch of salt. And you make a big deal about this in the book, that modeling is a very, very dangerous enterprise if you don't know what you're doing.
Absolutely. And I mean, I was so delighted to have William Briggs with us as a co-author because he really is a world expert on the use and misuse of models. Now, of course, there's things for which, I mean, it's great if you can develop a model and then you can test it against the real world, and you can tweak it. And so it could give you some insight about what might happen and sort of point you in the right direction for developing hypotheses. But a model is effectively a sophisticated argument that is run on a computer. You don't have a model, and it's not like with a model you take your computer and there's a probe and you sort of stick it into the ground with a thermometer. It's not directly connected to the physical world or to the evidence. You plug in assumptions based upon what you think might be true. And so with a model, you always want to, first you sort of develop it, then you'd say, okay, how good is this at predicting what happened in the past? So you test it against earlier data that you have. It's called retrodicting. And so that's a good first test. But then what you want to do, the proof is in the pudding, is now we'll let something happen and see if the model predicted that. And then you get more evidence to trust it. But in this case, we're dealing with a model, frankly, in a modeling shop that had a terrible track record on this. And by definition, it wasn't tested against reality. They were making assumptions about the infection fatality rate, about the spread and how likely it was to spread, about the effectiveness of lockdowns, basically all the things, all the questions that were being bagged effectively, all the things that really needed to be tested were just simply assumed in the model. And then, unfortunately, the director general of the World Health Organization got wind of this model at the Imperial College London. He told his counterparts in the UK and the United States, and then his counterparts told people like President Trump exactly what the model said. So President Trump was told, the president reported this on April the 8th. He said, well, the reason I thought that maybe lockdowns would make sense is two very smart people came into my office and said 2.2 million Americans are going to die if we don't lock down the country. Well, that 2.2 million Americans, that number, that came straight from the Imperial College London model. And so there was never any basis for that number except the assumptions of the model. And so now when we're talking about 200 and some odd thousand deaths, people say, well, yeah, but if we hadn't locked down, we'd have had, you know, 2.2 million deaths. No, there's no evidence of that. That was just based on the speculative model that literally within weeks we realized was absolutely not to be trusted. It wasn't even a well-designed model to begin with.
We hear phrases like follow the science, and we hear people saying, we've got to listen to the experts. I've often said that an X is a has-been and a spurt is a drip under pressure. But I mean, we bandy this word around, science and experts. What's your take on that?
Well, certainly we need expertise. And so the world's a complicated place. And so if I have heart disease, I want to talk to somebody that knows something about heart disease, right? I'm not going to ask the guy selling me newspapers at the corner. So that's fine as long as people stay in their lane. So you can trust an expert if he's a genuine expert when he's talking in his area of competence within his jurisdiction. The tyranny of experts is when you get these highly narrowly trained experts, and suddenly they're given jurisdiction over things over which they know nothing. That's more dangerous than trusting the guy at the fruit stand on the corner, because we tend to think, well, they're an expert, so they know what they're talking about. But they don't. Look, an immunologist doesn't have any more expertise in understanding the economic effects on, say, a lockdown than anybody else does. They'd need to be an expert in that. And that, unfortunately, was the danger. So in this case, we're sort of told this was based on the scientific experts, but it wasn't actually. It was based on the judgment of, so as far as I can tell, four or five people, scientific officials working for the federal government, against actually dozens of other experts who were silenced. Some of them, you know, experts would show up like Newt Witkowski on YouTube, and YouTube would pull them down because they contradicted the CDC or the World Health Organization. So what happened is that the media and the social media, the big tech giants, they all just decided, we are going to use these government officials, spokesmen for public health. They will be the sort of proxy for what science says. Because, of course, the media doesn't know how to do that. They don't know how to actually evaluate the scientific evidence. And so they essentially pick scientific prophets arbitrarily, as it turns out. And so that's why you could have hundreds or even thousands of scientists like you have at the Great Barrington Declaration saying this is a terrible idea. These people in the Great Barrington Declaration, many of them are far more credentialed than anybody working at the World Health Organization, and yet they were mostly ignored. There were voices crying in the wilderness from the very beginning. Science rarely speaks with one voice. And so if you want to know what the science says, you want to know what the scientific evidence is, you need to actually get talk to people with different perspectives that maybe have different interpretations, and just hope that in that process, in that debating process, the truth will come out. But you can't just trust a scientific official to be able to tell you that.
Help me understand what you're talking about when you're saying that you got to stay in your own lane, because it seems to me that there are problems with lanes. meaning that if all you have is expertise in a particular field, let's say you're a great golfer and you can really hit a golf ball and you're being asked about geopolitical realities around the world, well, that golfer, even though he's an expert at golf, is being asked about something that's not in his lane. Yet, I think there's a necessity for seeing the big picture, and that takes people that can get out of their lanes or maybe be experts in a lot of different fields.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's what at the end of the book that we actually advise. We think that's actually what politicians that are making major decisions need. They need committees of people, many of whom don't work for the government, that are otherwise independent, that includes both highly specialized experts, but also generalists. I mean, the reality is that some people specialize in being generalists. This is what Dr. Scott Atlas, who was a presidential advisor, he was formerly at Stanford Medical School, now at Hoover. He was a physician and a radiologist, but he developed an expertise in public health policy and in sort of focusing on the effects of that policy. That's something that you can learn about. And so you really need a mix of discerning generalists who kind of range more freely across several disciplines, and then experts. And you really kind of want both of those working together. Unfortunately, the media tends not to treat generalists and their discernment as if they have any value, even though ironically, journalists themselves tend to be generalists. It's just that they often don't know much about anything, you know? And so, but you're exactly right. I mean, this, as in many cases, both the natural and the supernatural gift of discernment and wisdom are just absolutely crucial to be able to recognize, okay, now this guy's an expert and he knows what he's talking about and I should trust him, versus there's something fishy about this and my spidey sense is going off. And this is one of those situations. It just happens to be a world historic situation where discernment was absolutely crucial.
The turn of phrases in the book are simply delicious. I mean, that's one of the things I appreciate about your writing skill and about your speaking skill. In The Price of Panic, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe, you have these delicious phrases. Like, for example, governments tend to produce one size fits, nobody plans.
No, it's exactly right. I mean, this is the problem because COVID-19, our response to lock everyone down actually doesn't make any sense for anyone. So locking down a kid and not letting a little kid go to school, it's not like, well, why does the kid have to do that? He's not at risk. But it's not like that's even protecting the elderly woman in a nursing home who's unaffected by that. Whereas what you actually want to do is you want a targeted approach because we don't have an infinite amount of kind of attention and resources, especially public health resources. And so that you really want a targeted approach. Just imagine if all this energy and time and it's kind of emotional support and money that we've squandered with these lockdowns had actually been focused on the people that were most vulnerable, really screening them carefully, and then really doing a serious quarantine with people that are infectious, how different this would have been. But instead, we just did this, one size fits nobody, and it ends up harming everyone, unfortunately.
One of the things you note is that Facebook and YouTube, so it's not only big media, it's big tech, it's big money, they're sort of creepy protectors of the party line. And that's really become a dangerous kind of new strain within our culture.
It has. And in fact, honestly, Hank, that's the thing that finishing this book has got me the most worried now, because the reality is I used to in the 20th century and, in my book, Money, Greed, and God, I mainly focused on the kind of socialism of the 20th century in which you have the centralized state exercising its power and, like the Soviet Union confiscating and nationalizing all the factories and all the farms and driving the peasants off the land and killing millions of people. And well, no one, there's a few cranky people that advocate that kind of full communism. But the reality is I think something like this weird sort of the Great Reset that the World Economic Forum is talking about, which you get this creepy kind of collusion between big government and big corporations, and especially big tech. Because in big tech, what we're dealing with, I'm talking about Facebook and Twitter and Google in particular, is that they control the flow of information now. In fact, even major media companies are beholden to these big tech platforms for the transmission of information. And so when they suddenly decide they're going to sort of bias the transmission of information in favor of a particular political view, that is a new and really, really scary thing. And so that's why you say at the end of the book that, the tyranny that comes in the 21st century may not come. It probably won't come with a hammer or sickle or you know, with a swastika. It may come with stock options, you know, and social support. I mean, that's, I think, what we're dealing with. And this is, this is the thing I'm now spending most of my time worrying about, is just this scary collusion between workers in public health bureaucracies and government bureaucracies and the people who control the flow of information. I really think that is the most important kind of social dynamic we're going to have to deal with here in the beginning of the 21st century.
And as you have pointed out, well-informed people that are free do about as well as people under compulsion, and they do it with far less collateral damage.
Absolutely. I mean, the reality is we ran the numbers. We took all of the case curves of all the countries and all the individual states, and then we superimposed on that in the book all of the particular lockdowns, the exact dates when the lockdowns happened or didn't happen. And we said, look, if the lockdowns matter, we should see a bend in those curves about 10 days after the lockdowns go into effect. So that would be evidence the lockdowns make a difference. There was no evidence whatsoever that they make a difference. So there's basically no signal in the noise. And the reality is we suspect that people were already responding and doing about all that we would sort of naturally do based upon our local knowledge. I mean, if you know you have lung problems and you're worried about it, you're going to act differently than if you don't. And, you know, that's part of what it means to live in a free society, is that on many things you trust people to use their local knowledge to the best of their ability in making decisions. And the lockdowns basically don't do that. They just treat us all like children.
You know, something came into my mind as you were talking, and that is I was taking a flight a week or so ago to Dallas. And sort of, again, on the theme of cognitive dissonance, I'm in the airport. The airport's crowded. People are trying to get onto the plane, and they're not social distancing. I mean, they're like a mass of humanity trying to get on that plane first so that they can have space for their luggage.
Yes.
And everybody's pushing. You end up on the plane. The plane is completely filled. And by the way, I took this flight last minute, so I couldn't get any preferential seating. So I ended up in a middle seat, both on the flight there and on the flight back. And I'm thinking about all of this. I'm thinking, wow, here I am. I've just gone through almost a four-year battle with cancer. I'm wearing a little mask. I'm on a plane with all kinds of people, but I got on that plane in a herd. And I'm thinking, you know, this doesn't make any sense, because the next day I'm going to go to church and every other pew is marked off with tape. You look at it, and I think of my mother. She died when she was 93, not all that long ago. And she used to, she old school from Holland, and she's seen it all. She was involved in the Dutch underground, helping Jews and trying to stop the nefarious Nazi machine. Well, she looks at these things and she just looks at them with common sense, and she goes, in her mind, and it usually comes out in words, she'll say, stupid people. But I mean, that's what I thought, you know, when I was thinking, you know, I'm going to go to church and the pews are going to be marked off. And here I've just been in the airport and I've been in a mass of humanity.
No, you know, I have had the same experience several times, because I think I had all of my out-of-town events canceled for several months, which was actually merciful, because it gave me time, honestly, to write the book, because I did never leave the house. But once I started traveling again, of course, you know, they're trying to sort of maintain these policies. But of course, we're crammed in together when you're on the plane. But inevitably, when they say, okay, now we're getting off the plane, so be sure to maintain social distancing. It's like, well, I was just sitting 12 inches from this guy, and now I'm going to stay 6 feet from him. I mean, yeah, it really is. This is why so much of this, it really is hygiene theater. And I honestly think some of the public health officials almost know this. They almost know, okay, this probably doesn't make any difference, but maybe it will help people feel better about themselves. In fact, even Dr. Fauci, who initially said masks, it's stupid to wear masks, then later he said, well, maybe masks don't make a difference, but they help people feel better. He sort of, that was sort of like his outside voice. You know, he should have kept his inside voice and not said that publicly. But I honestly think maybe that's what they're thinking. They don't bother to do it themselves if they need to go to the restaurant or the hairdresser. But they think, well, it's good for the little people because it gives them something to do and helps them feel like they're keeping themselves and others safe. So let's sort of maintain it. I mean, I really do think a lot of this hygiene theater. I just really hope that a year from now we can look back on it and at least say, and what got into us? I pray we will not still be having the same conversation a year from now.
You mentioned Gavin Newsom, a petty tyrant. He admitted that the pandemic was an opportunity to pursue a new progressive agenda. What is the interrelationship between this pandemic and a progressive agenda?
I mean, you know, I don't think that this happened because of that. I think it was a sort of target of opportunity, but you have Newsom. You actually have several politicians, including, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You have the head of the World Economic Forum, who basically said this is an opportunity for us to do some of the things that we're hoping to do. I mean, I honestly think a public health crisis is really the best tool for getting people to comply. I mean, things like, I think they'll try it with climate change, but climate change is so sort of distant that it doesn't have the kind of effect. But being told that, look, you have to do this, or you could die, or you could kill someone else, that has a kind of rhetorical power to get us to comply that I think almost nothing else does. And so that's why anyone that's wanting to sort of increase the power of the state and increase the control of the political realm over civil society, I mean, they're noticing this. They're noticing how much we comply. And that's why I think we have to sort of increase our vigilance. And it doesn't mean that when there's a public health crisis, we're just obnoxious. But it means that we really need to look at the details to make sure that we're not being buffaloed again.
Let's talk about the takeaway for this discussion. And you just mentioned global warming, which is now no longer global warming. It's climate change. But you talked about, when you're talking about that issue, you're talking about how important it is for people to learn to ask the right questions and to ask those right questions in the right order. That's true with climate change. It's also true with this pandemic.
Absolutely. And I mean, the first things we should have been asking is, okay, exactly how dangerous is this? How does this bug compare to other bugs that we've known about historically, you know, especially viruses and other pandemics? What policies and responses are most likely to help? And what are the consequences of the policies that were being proposed? I mean, these are just not rocket science. It's not that complicated. We had a rough estimate about the infection fatality rate in the spring, and we knew pretty much what it was in the summer. In fact, our number now, it actually conforms to what the CDC and the World Health Organization have figured out. We could figure out very quickly what the consequences of lockdowns were going to be. And we knew what the traditional response was, which was quarantining the sick. It wasn't locking down entire populations. And so it's like we've gotten these kind of mind worms in which we think that lockdowns are a normal response, a kind of intuitive response to lock everyone down. We just are assuming that this is a historically deadly bug, when all you'd have to do is look at the CDC to figure out it's just not true. We've gotten all these things in our heads, and they came directly from a distorted and biased media. That's where we're getting our information. That's why I always tell people, I don't want to have big arguments on social media. I say, look, don't trust me. Just go to the CDC website and do some arithmetic and just run the numbers. You don't have to believe me. And you'll see that this bug is not as deadly as you actually think it is, because you want to know what the baseline is. Otherwise, every flu and cold season, we're going to be doing lockdowns and making everybody wear masks. And that's just crazy.
Maybe the last thing I want to talk about is just the vaccines, because they are around the corner and we've mentioned them in this podcast. But give people a sense of what they ought to be thinking about when they're thinking about whether or not to comply to the orders, maybe the orders to take the vaccines.
Well, I think if there's a universal order to take the vaccine, that's going to be a completely different thing. I would oppose that vociferously. I think there's not, in terms of kind of the ethical sourcing of the vaccines, they're not any worse than lots of other vaccines. There's always kind of complexities there. But I think really the main thing everyone should ask is, okay, what is my risk? In particular, right? It might sound self-interested, but that's really the question. When you're having someone administer medicine, what's your risk? And then what's the risk of the people that you genuinely are around? And so if you're at fairly high risk, that is from COVID-19, it is really of a danger to you, then I think it makes perfect sense that you'd probably take the risk of the vaccine, at least as soon as we kind of have some information. But the reality is taking that vaccine is a risky action, because we just don't know what it's, either its short-term or its long-term consequences are. It hasn't been through the regular protocols. On the other hand, if COVID-19 is not a high risk, if you're a young child and you're not interacting with lots of high-risk people, it doesn't really make any sense. I can say for myself, my kids are older now, they're teenagers, but I absolutely would resist giving young children this vaccine, because I just think the risk-reward ratio makes absolutely no sense. We don't know what really the long-term consequences of the vaccine are, and we know that kids are about four times more likely to die of the flu than COVID-19. And so if you don't vaccinate your kids for the flu, it makes absolutely no sense to vaccinate them for COVID-19. If you do get them vaccinated for the flu, then just do that calculation, but realize that they're more at risk of the flu than they are at COVID-19. And I think that fact ought to shape the decisions that we make.
I want to read one endorsement. There's so many wonderful endorsements of your book, but here's a past president of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons who says, "We physicians appropriately focus on an individual patient's medical problems as we see them before us. Very few of us have the knowledge or wisdom to balance the much larger issues that are involved in responding to public health pandemics with major economic and political impacts. This book puts these issues into perspective by showing that the illness and death toll from the COVID-19 virus was unremarkable in comparison with many historical pandemics. What was remarkable is how we reacted. The authors explore this and other important issues, such as why COVID-19 pandemic incited worldwide panic, whereas previous pandemics did not. This book also shows how most decision makers relied way too heavily on gimmicks such as computer models to arrive at disastrous decisions." The reason I bring that up is here you have a very significant individual, a past president of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, writing about the significance of this book. Whereas when I started promoting this book, I had constituents who got very, very angry, who were saying all kinds of acerbic things. You know, don't go into the hospital. You know, you're worshiping some false gods. And I mean, just very, very strident because of what you've written. And yet the people that really know what's going on, they're saying this is an incredibly insightful book, something that everyone needs to consider, not only reading, but comprehending.
Well, I certainly hope that that's the case. And we wanted to write the book not just for scientific experts, but for the general public. We, of course, worried, but to write it in a really short deadline, and there's a whole lot of data in the book that we would make some serious mistakes. Fortunately, we had really smart people, including that Dr. Robert Chihok, who read the manuscript for us and caught lots of things. And so, you know, honestly, we can't stop what's already happened, but we really hope we can at least play a role in preventing us from making the same mistake twice.
How do you come up with the title?
Well, honestly, the title we had was originally called What Just Happened, because we thought by the time the book came in October, it would all be over. But as it sort of ground on, we thought, no, that's not really what it's about. And we realized that really what it's about is that we think about the cost or the price of the coronavirus, and really what the book is about is the price of the panic. And so I think it was actually the president of Gregory Publishing that just, you know, had one of these insightful moments in which he came up with that title, and we were tickled pink, thought, yeah, that's definitely a winner.
Yeah, and it's not only a winner in terms of the title, but the subtitle, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe. And we want to make this book available to everyone listening in, those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us at Hank Unplugged. You can get your copy on the web at equip.org or by writing me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Jay, you never cease to amaze me. You are not only a gift to the body of Christ, but a gift to the world. And I really thank you for the hard work that goes into being able to communicate these complex issues to people in a way that they can assimilate and actually use to make a betterment in culture and certainly in the church world.
Thanks so much, Hank. It's been great to be with you.
Yeah, as always, it was fantastic having Dr. Jay Richards with us on Hank Unplugged again. The Price of Panic, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe, available for all of you who stand shoulder to shoulder with me in the battle for life and truth. This book, I mean, it really is a must read for a lot of reasons, particularly because you want to know what truth entails. You want to develop discernment skills, because this is not the last big issue that's going to come down the line. We are faced with all kinds of complex issues. And when you read a book like this, in fact, read any of Jay Richards' books, you're going to develop discernment skills. It's going to be extraordinarily helpful. I was thinking about the book that he wrote, Eat, Fast, Feast, a book that had an enormous impact on my own life In fact, I'm rereading it again to make sure I stick with the principles in that book. I mean, he talks about all of the misconceptions with respect to fasting and puts them into perspective and then shows you how understanding fasting properly can have a great impact on your life today. So it's not only great for spiritual reasons, and that's paramount, but it is also very, very significant from a medical standpoint. So yeah, I really appreciate Jay Richards. And if you go to the web at equip.org, you'll see the books that he has written, any of those books available for those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. And of course, when we're talking about this, we're really talking about the fact that truth really, really matters. So thanks again for tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward with anticipation to the next episode coming up very, very soon. So long for now.